ॐ सहनाववतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहैः ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः चैतन्यं सर्वगं सर्वं सर्वभूतगुहाशयं यत् सर्वविषयातीतं तस्मै सर्वविदे नमः ॐ. Good, welcome back. We continue our study of this wonderful text of Sri Shankara. Just a quick comment, if you are using these slides, which you might find helpful, the version that was earlier on our website only has the first half of the chapter. I want to tell you that the entire chapter is now available if you want your own copy of these slides. I use them to make all my notes for each class. All right. Welcome also to all the students taking this class online. That's we get some nice comments, and I'm grateful for that. So in this chapter, Sri Shankara takes a number of topics. So far, the main topics have been two. One is the importance of shifting, I'm choosing my words a little carefully, shifting your identification from your body and mind to your true self as pure consciousness. That expression of shifting turns out to be really, really crucial. And I think we'll see this as the class goes on. So one is disidentification, body-mind, proper identification with your true nature as consciousness. Having done so, you are then freed from all the problems of your body and mind, so you achieve a condition which we have called kritta krityata, a state of complete contentment, which is one of the main lakshanas, main signs of enlightenment. That contentment in the sense that there's nothing that could be made better. Imagine having that feeling. Nothing at all in my life could possibly be better than it is now. That is the sense of kritta krityata. Okay, with that introduction, we can pick up the thread. The prior verse talked about the that shifting of identification shifting your identification to your true nature as chit, as pure consciousness. And that is what we pick up on right now, the nature of that true consciousness in verse 26. Drishtih sarvamatir jnatihi, drishtih shruti matir jnatihi, swapne drishta janai sada, swapne drishta janai sada, tasam atma swarupatvat, tasam atma swarupastvat, atah pratyakshatatmanah, atah pratyakshatatmanah. Drishtihi shrutihi, I misspoke. Start in the second line. Swapne, in your dreams. Drishta, the seer of those dreams, the witness of those dreams, the experiencer of those dreams. Who is he talking about? Consciousness. That consciousness by which your dreams is known, that consciousness, janaihi, It is drishta janaihi, experienced by janaihi, by all people. Sada, always experienced by all people. Whatever happens in your dream is experienced. And what is it that happens in your dream? First line, drishtihi. In your dream, you see things. In your dream, shrutihi, you hear things. In your dreams, matihi, you think. In your dreams, jnatihi, you know. So dream world is like a representation of this world. Whatever happens in this world happens also in your dream world. So what? You know, that's well known to us all. Shankara's point here is interesting. It doesn't come to the last line. Tasam, of those experiences of seeing, hearing, thinking, and knowing, tasam, let me take this last line first. Ataha, they therefore pratyakshata atmanaha. Atmanaha, for your true self, for consciousness, all those experiences in a dream have pratyakshata, immediacy. They are immediately perceived by you in a dream. Why? Atma sarupatvat. Because they are not separate from you. They are, you know, and I don't want it, this is not the time for big, long technical discussion because we have some nice verses ahead. So let me suggest some ways of understanding one of our favorite topics in this chapter that I didn't mention before is relationship between consciousness and mind. We talked about that on several occasions. Here are two alternate ways to understand that. We've seen a variety of ways to understand that relationship. Two alternates are, one, where are thoughts located? This is the easy one. Where are your thoughts located? The simple answer is in consciousness. Right? Thoughts are located in consciousness. A little bit like the avachedavara, and again, I don't want to get into all these details here, where we discussed like waves are in water and waves are non-separate from water. We can say these vrittis, these mental events are in consciousness and non-separate from consciousness. Actually, a second one I'll set aside because it's a little more obscure. So the point Shankara is making here is whatever happens in your mind, all those vrittis are in consciousness, we could say in you, because you are that consciousness. There's no gap, no distance between whatever happens in your mind and you, the sakshi, the witness of those mental events, vrittis. Therefore, everything happening in your mind has, for Atma, it is pratyaksha. It is immediately perceived. Directly perceived is even better. Then what is his point? He leaves it unsaid. What is unsaid? He made reference to dream. What about waking state? He left it unsaid, assuming that you'll figure it out, because in waking state, your experience of the world is not pratyaksha. It is not direct. And it's a little play on words. Pratyaksha often means what you see with, what you perceive with your senses. Here he is using the word pratyaksha in a slightly different way to mean that which is directly known. And the point he's making then is a point that you've learned already in prior classes, is that the world outside is known to you only indirectly, as opposed to whatever happens in your mind, which is known directly. And the reason it's known directly is those thoughts exist in consciousness like waves exist in water. Waves exist in water. Waves are non-separate from that water. In the same way, everything you experience, like right now, whatever is happening right now, where does that experience take place? In your consciousness. In you. And what is the distance between what you experience and consciousness? There's distance out here in the world. In here, there's no distance whatsoever. Okay, then let's move on. He actually shifts to another topic. We mentioned in several ways, he's going to talk about that state of krita-krityata, that state of utter fulfillment. He has a variety of approaches for describing it. He begins, paraloka-bhayam yasya, paraloka-bhayam yasya, nasti mrityubhayam tata, nasti mrityubhayam tata, tasyatmajnasya shochyasyuhu, tasmatmajnasya shochyasyuhu, sabramhendra apishwaraha, sabramhendra apishwaraha. Sabrahma indraha api ishvaraha. Okay. Yasya, for the enlightened person. And notice how we've been defining the enlightened person in this class. One who has shifted one's identification from body, mind to consciousness. That's a great description of enlightenment. Yasya, for that person, paraloka bhayam nasti. Nasti, there is no bhaya, fear, of paraloka. Paraloka means another world, in this case, another life. So the enlightened person has no fear of getting reborn as a cockroach, as I've joked with you before. No fear at all. Why? Consciousness doesn't get reborn. And also, nasti, that person has no mrityubhayam tata. Tata also, that person has no bhaya, fear of mrityu, of death. Why? Consciousness doesn't die. So it's so obvious that as soon as you shift your identification from body, mind to consciousness, all suffering goes away. There's nothing to fear because nothing can affect that consciousness. If death cannot affect it, then how can anything else? There's actually a technical term. They call this pratama mala nyaya. Some of you know this. Mala is this wrestler. In modern times, we don't have wrestling as much as this boxing, which is such a brutal sport. Anyway, if you want to be the number one wrestler or boxer, you don't have to defeat everyone. You only have to defeat the current number one. There could be dozens of them out there, but if you want to be number one, there's only one person you have to defeat. And that's the reasoning used here. If Atma is not affected by death, then how could it be affected by anything else? Okay. So, tasya, I think Shankara is must be in a good mood here. He's playful. Interesting to call Shankara Acharya playful, but that's how it looks to me. Tasya atma gnyasya, for that enlightened person who has no fear of rebirth, who has no fear of death, what about him? Sab, Brahma Indra Api Ishvaraha, the Ishvaraha, the gods, Api, even the gods, what gods? Sabrahma Indra, gods like Brahmaji and Indra, king of the gods. So for the enlightened person, even those gods, Shochyahas Yuhu, would be pitiable. Pitiable, why? The enlightened person feels bad. Oh, poor Indra. Now, it's a little obscure. You have to appreciate some features of Hindu mythology to understand that, especially with regard to Indra. Indra is king of the gods only for one cycle of creation, one kalpa. When the kalpa comes to an end, he gets kicked out, like the president gets kicked out after his term is over. In this way, the Indra gets replaced at the end of his term, so to speak, at the end of the kalpa. So the implication then is Indra is worrying about the end of his reign as king. And the enlightened person says, what is that? Too bad. Poor Indra. So you see what I mean by a playful attitude here. And he seizes on this idea and expands on it in the next verse. Let's see that. Ishvaratvena kim tasya, Ishvaratvena kim tasya, Brahmendratvena vapunaha, Brahmendratvena vapunaha, Trishna chet sarvatashchinna, Trishna chet sarvatashchinna, sarvadainyodbhavashubha, sarvadainyodbhavashubha. Let me introduce this verse with this thought. We've talked so many times about how spiritual pursuit begins when you recognize the limitations of what you can accomplish in this world. In worldly life, you can have some happiness, some contentment, but it's never complete. Partial happiness, partial contentment. So recognizing the limitations of what can be gained in worldly life is the beginning of spiritual pursuit. You've heard this several times. Suppose someone, especially someone who is well-versed in Hindu mythology and very devotional and very given to rituals, very ritualistic person. Suppose this person says, well, if worldly goals will never make me completely content, maybe I can go and dwell in heaven, some loka. Maybe I can do enough rituals and accumulate enough good karma that I can finally reach the realm of the gods. And I can, pardon my American English, I can hang out with Indra and Brahma and the other gods. So suppose someone has this orientation that instead of pursuing worldly goals, they want to achieve some kind of heavenly goal. And that's what Shankara addresses here. He says, Kim Ishvratvena? It's an idiom. What is the use of becoming a god in heaven? Like what? Brahma Indratvena. A god like Brahma or Indra Vapunaha. He says, what is the use of becoming a god in heaven, tasya, for one, I'll drop down to the second half, for one, trishna chet, if their desires, sarvataha chinna, if their desires are chinna, destroyed, removed, sarvataha, completely removed, If one's desires here and now are completely removed, then Shankara says, what is the use of going to heaven? If you are utterly content right now, how is going to heaven going to be any better? How can you improve on it? That was my description of krita krityata before, and I think this is a very meaningful and relevant way of describing it. A condition where you truly feel nothing needs to be changed or improved for your sake. Nothing could improve upon your current situation. Not in this world, not even in a heavenly domain. So this is accomplished through the removal of trishna, desire. That's the enlightened person is completely freed from those binding desires, that raga and dvesha, those compulsions. And those compulsions which are sarva, dainya, udbhava, ashubha. Those desires are the ashubha, I've paraphrased it here as a cause for suffering. The cause for suffering, if ashubha literally means impurity here, but impure in the sense of that which makes you suffer. That's our context here. And so those, it causes suffering. What is it that causes suffering? Trishna, those binding desires, raga, dvesha. And they are the sarva dainya udbhava. They are the udbhava, the origin. Those desires are the origin of sarva dainya. And Shankara is having some fun now with language. Dainya means smallness. And what's interesting here is the first word in this verse, Ishwaratva, is an, remember the antonym? Did you learn that word in a grammar class a million years ago? Ishwaratva and Dainya are antonyms. Ishwaratva means grandness, bigness. I don't know what would be a better English word. Doesn't translate that well into English. Dainya is the opposite. Smallness. Ishwaratva, the closest, a good English word is majesty. How's that? Ishwaratva, majesty. And dainya, the absolute opposite. This smallness, insignificance, is it? So to look at Shankara's use of these antonyms in his verse, he says, you go to heaven and you get Ishwaratva, you get the majestic life in heaven as a heavenly being, as a god. But what is the necessity for that? If you can have Ishwaratva now, what does that mean? Ishwaratva, since Ishwaratva and Dainya are antonyms, you get rid of Dainya and you have Ishwaratva. That's the sense here. Dainya is a sense of smallness and limitation. And that sense of smallness and limitation obviously comes through identification with the body and mind. When you shift your identification from body-mind to consciousness, as we've said so many times, what happens to that dainya? Consciousness has no dainya means smallness. Consciousness has no smallness, no limitation. It's utterly free from the defects of the body and mind. This is crucial because our bodies and minds have so many defects. Everyone, Every single one of us have physical and mental defects, and one to the extent that we identify with our bodies and minds, we suffer as a result of those mental and physical defects. Can you remove all those defects? The sad truth is, especially the physical defects are only going to grow in number. They're not going to decrease in number. So, what is the solution? The solution is to shift your identification from body and mind so that you are free of the defects of the body and mind. That's the dānya. And when you are free of that smallness and limitation of the body and mind, when you are identified with pure consciousness, you're done. Some of you say, sub-kam, ho-gaya. That's the sense of krita-krityata. Everything that needs to be done is done. And that's what Shankaracharya is describing here. Now, in the next verse, this is brilliant, his next verse. I'm just enjoying this text so much because it really shows off why, it really demonstrates, this text really demonstrates why Shankara is such an important figure in the tradition of Advaita Vedanta. His teachings are so profound and clear. In fact, these are the two adjectives most often used to describe Shankaracharya's teachings is prasanna, clear, which means easy to understand, and at the same time, gambhira, very deep. Very profound. Usually those two things don't go together, right? If something is very profound, it's hard to understand. If something is easy to understand, it's not very profound. So Shankara's teachings manage to combine these two. He teaches the most profound truths in a manner that is easily grasped. And we'll see that. Oh, the specific thing. Actually, I'll let Shankara, I don't need to introduce this. I'll let Shankara speak to us, so to speak.
Mamet yatmi adhirapi, mamet atmi adhirapi, artha shunye yada yasya, artha shunye yada yasya, sa atmagnyo bhavetara, sa atmagnyo bhavetsada.
Absolutely gambhira, profound, and prasanna, so easily understood. He begins by talking about aham iti, that sense of I-ness, that atmadhihi. Atmadhihi means the conclusion about oneself. He's obviously talking about ahankara. Atmadhi means ahankara. It's the so-called I thought. In fact, atmadhi means I thought. That atmadhi, I thought, is in what form? Aham iti. I am this, I am that, I am this, I am that. So he says that atmadhi, that ahankara, that I thought, also, and you see at the end of the last, of the second line, api, also, mama iti, the thought mine, mama iti, which is atmiyadi. If ahamdi means I thought, atmiyadi means my thought. I thought and my thought. Aham is the pronoun I, mama is the pronoun me, mine, sorry. And atmiya is a grammatical way of saying mine. So he's talking about the I thought and the my thought. I thought, ahankara, my thought. So this pretty much encompasses all worldly life. I and mine. How often are those expressions used? Now, we've reflected before on the enlightened person is not one whose sense of I and mine have been destroyed. This is such a common wrong conclusion. Of course, we use that language too casually, and I would suggest too casually. Very often, we say the enlightened person is one who has no sense of I or mine. There are so many texts and teachings which say that in one way or another. But that leads to these real peculiar problems. I mentioned before the great saint who never uses the term I or mine. This is teaching. This came into the lecture hall a half hour ago. This is hungry. This is tired. And we've had a discussion before. Why should an enlightened person develop an allergy to the word I? It's just a word. Why do you need to be afraid of the word I or mine? My clothes. The clothes that belong to this one. My ashram. The ashram that belong... I said the other day, it's not my ashram anyway, it's your ashram, but figuratively speaking, the ashram that belongs to this one. How arbitrary, how unnecessary, and that's what Shankara makes so blatantly clear in this verse. He says, yasya, one for whom... Those two, the I thought and the my thought, one for whom those two thoughts are artashunya, meaningless. They're just thoughts, like any other thought. And right now, in your experience, is the room and me and the other students and all of this, is any of that you? There's a bunch of stuff. A bunch of stuff crammed into your mind. One of the many things crammed into your mind is the feeling that I am sitting here. The feeling that I am sitting here right now is just another mental event. No different than any other mental event. It's just a bunch of stuff in your mind, which is why Shankara calls it artha shunya. It is devoid of any reality. It's just passing thoughts, like passing waves on the water. These are just passing thoughts in consciousness. And the enlightened person, just to finish the verse, he says, yada, when the I thought and my thought, the sense of I-ness and my-ness, when these two ideas are known as being artha-shunya. Artha-shunya is dual in number, these two. So, or could also be locative. So when they are known as being meaningless, mere thoughts, tada, in the last line, tada, then saha atmagnyaha bhavet. Even if you don't know much Sanskrit, you can probably figure that out. Saha, that person, bhavet, becomes atmagnyaha, a true knower of atma. One who knows the I thought and my thought, and Shankara's expression here is brilliant. Artha shunya, devoid of reality. And allow me to do this with you once again. These are like, some people would call this an open eye meditation. An open eye meditation means a contemplation. So you reflect on your experience. Right now, as I said before, what's present in your experience is all the stuff around us. Your body is present in your experience. Your mind is present in your experience. The sound of my voice and the image of my body are all present in your experience. Also present in your experience is the feeling. By the way, can you feel the chair on which you're sitting? You feel. You feel the chair below you. Do you feel yourself sitting in the chair? You feel yourself sitting in the chair. It's not just a feeling of chair. The feeling also includes you. You are sitting on the chair. That feeling that you are sitting here is a feeling. It's just another mental event. Just a thought. Just a vritti. And as such, artha shunya, devoid of independent reality. So, where is the need for an enlightened person to avoid the words I and mine? Or even I want. My guru often said, I want a cup of coffee. He liked coffee. So he said, I want. So what? People get so upset about this and make such a big deal of it. He said, I want coffee? Is he really enlightened? Come on. It's a matter of language, mere language. Why should we elevate this language to such status? Also, finally, the sense of I and mine. This is a point that my guru himself made many times, an important point. Why should anything in your mind be an enemy? Let's look at this a little bit. Before enlightenment, raga and dvesha are definitely enemies, right? They get you into trouble again and again and again. They cause lots of suffering. So the enlightened person, as you know, is free from that raga dvesha. But the enlightened person still has lots of other stuff in his or her mind, like the I thought and the my thought. Suppose the enlightened person, let me refine my language. Suppose someone who understands one's true nature as consciousness, suppose that person has a wrong conclusion that I won't be enlightened until this I thought goes away. Think about that. The person knows I am Satchidananda Atma, so he has that understanding, that insight. But has this false conclusion. How can I be enlightened? This is still me. I'm still here. I still feel like an individual being. Look at that. And a person says, I still feel like an individual being. How can I be enlightened? You can answer that now. That feeling of being an individual being is, in Shankara's words, artha shunya. It has no reality. It's just a thought. Why should we be afraid of thoughts? Enough said. Okay, I like that very, very much. Okay, we have time to see some more.
Buddha dao satyupadhau cha. Buddha dao satyupadhau cha. Tatha satya visheshata. Tatha satya visheshata. Yasya chedatmano gnata. Yasya chedatmano gnata. Tasya karyam katam bhavet. Tasya karyam katam bhavet.
Again, krita krityata. You can see in that final line. Start in the beginning.
Buddhi adau upadau sati.
You have to break all these words apart.
Buddhi, mind, intellect, adau, etc.
Simply body and mind. That's all it means, buddha adau. Notice Shankara uses his technical language, which are upadhis, upadhau. The body and mind he calls upadhis. Remember, upadhi is a highly technical term that's used in Advaita Vedanta. But here he's not using it in a real technical way. He's just talking about body and mind. So don't get hung up, so to speak, on that word upadhi. So he's saying, buddha dao upadhau sati. When the body and mind exist, that sati is a present participle, when they exist, when do the body and mind exist? Right now, they exist. What about in dream? Then your body isn't present in your experience, but your mind still is. So these two upadhis are both present in the waking state. One of them, the mind, is present in the dream state. And then in deep sleep, tata, and also asati, when they are absent. So both body and mind are absent from your experience in deep sleep. So with regard to the presence or absence, I'm paraphrasing the first half. With regard to the presence and absence of your experience of the body and mind, yasya, for the enlightened person, there is, then the key word here is, avisheshata. You have to break the words apart again. Avisheshata. Literally, there's no difference. And in American English, there's actually an American mudra for this. You know the Americans have mudras. They do. This is one. Who cares? How's that? An American mudra. Who cares? And that's a sense of that avisheshata. It doesn't make any difference whether the body and mind are present or absent. Who cares? For the enlightened person. What difference does it make? For one who is fully identified with consciousness. Truly, who cares? What difference does it make? That is Shankara's point. He says, yasya, for that person who is jnata, the knower of atma, atmanaha of atma, ched, if that person knows atma to such an extent, because there's no extent, if that person truly knows atma, truly knows oneself as atma, and knowing oneself as atma, that person has that sense, who cares? Body, mind present, body, mind absent, what difference does it make? yasya, for such a person, tasya, for that person, karyam katam bhavet. Katam bhavet, how could there be any karyam? Karyam literally means that which needs to be done. And I like to translate that as agenda, a word that my guru was very, he liked that word. An agenda means something you need to do, full stop. Something on your to-do list is that agenda. And the idea is, if it doesn't need to be done, you wouldn't have written it on your to-do list, right? Which means it makes a difference. If it is undone, there's some negative consequence. If you tick off that item on your to-do list, there's some positive consequence. These negative and positive consequences is worldly life. You do something makes you happy, something makes you unhappy, something brings you joy, something makes you suffer. It's all worldly life. The enlightened person, you know, in a facetious way, has no to-do list. That's that state of krita-krityata we've been discussing, that condition in which nothing needs to be done. Nothing can be improved upon. That is so contrary to conventional thinking. Because usually we're always on the lookout, so to speak. What can I do next? What can I get next? What will bring me even more happiness and contentment? But when you recognize your true nature as pure consciousness, or let me stay with the same language, when you shift your identification from body and mind to your true nature as pure consciousness, how can you improve on consciousness? And just take a moment to reflect on this. Consciousness is unborn, uncreated. How can you improve on that? Not subject to death. Consciousness is full, complete, perfect. How can you improve on that? Consciousness is unchanging. That is such an important teaching. Because your consciousness is unchanging, nothing can drag it down. Conversely, if it's unchanging, how can you improve on it? It can't be less than it is. It can't be more than it is, being unchanging. Recognizing yourself as that consciousness. Shishankara says, karyam katam bhavet. How can there be anything more to be accomplished? Okay, same thought is expressed in one more verse, and we'll see that here at the end of our class. Prasanne vimale vyomni, prasanne vimale vyomni, prajnanai karase dvaye, utpannatma dhiyo bruta, utpannatma dhiyo bruta, kimanyat karyam ishyate, kimanyat karyam ishyate. From that last line, you can see Shankara is still talking about kritta krityata. Start in the third line. Utpanna atma dhiyaha. You really have to know some grammar to make sense out of this. It's genitive, right? So for one who has dhi, knowledge, it means in this context. For one who knows, for one whose knowledge, what kind of knowledge? Atma dhi, knowledge of atma. For one whose knowledge of atma has utpanna, arisen. for one who has gained knowledge of Atma. And knowledge of Atma, that term is used so often, and it gives completely the wrong sense. Because we have knowledge of so many things, so what? This Atma-jnana is utterly like any other kind of knowledge. When we call it knowledge, knowledge is the right word, because knowledge destroys ignorance. But that word knowledge is so often misunderstood in this context. You know, I know that I'm sitting here. I know how to use a computer. I know how to make a peanut butter and banana sandwich. How's that? I know all these things, and I know Atma. Huh? I know how to make a sandwich, and I also know Atma, by the way. You see my point? That word knowledge doesn't fully capture the profundity of what it means to discover your true nature as pure consciousness. We use that language, Atma-jnana, and it's the correct language, but don't be fooled. The word knowledge is not an ordinary knowledge whatsoever. It is a discovery, an immediate and personal and direct discovery of your true nature as pure consciousness, unborn, uncreated, unchanging. For such a person who is established in prajnana eka rase advaye, established in that which is that, this is describing consciousness. Consciousness which is eka rasa, having one essence. Generally, we would translate that as undifferentiated, partless. Eka rasa, undifferentiated consciousness. It means there are no good bits and bad bits. Think about it. If there were good parts, there would necessarily be bad parts. If consciousness had parts, if it had good parts, then definitely it would have some bad parts. It has no parts. Partless. Eka rasa, of one nature, undifferentiated what? Prajnana. Prajnana here means consciousness. Undifferentiated consciousness, which is advaya, non-dual. We've had this discussion many times. That is, the consciousness in your mind, the consciousness that reveals what's happening right now in your mind, and the consciousness that reveals what's happening in my mind. How to tell the difference? You can tell the difference between your mind and my mind. You can tell the difference between what your eyes see and my eyes see. You see Swami Taratmananda sitting on a chair. I see all of you sitting in this classroom. So there's a huge difference at that level. But what is the difference in, let me use the word, knowingness? Knownness, even better. The known, there's difference in your experience and my experience. Absolutely. The knownness of your experience and the knownness of my experience, how to tell the difference? The knownness is identical. Experiences are different. Knownness is identical. And that's that one consciousness, the advaya, the non-dual consciousness, which is ekarasa. It is non-dual like, and the first line gives a metaphor, prasanne vimale vyomni, like vyoman, space, which is vimala, in this, literally free from impurities. Here, space has no color, right? You know, here if you look up, you'll see blue, or today I think you'll see gray. And if you're in outer space, you see black. So which is right? Is space gray, blue, black? Colorless, right? That's the point. Space is colorless, which the metaphor here means your consciousness is colorless in the sense that it is unaffected by your experience right now. Just as space is not experienced, when you put pollution into the air, which is a huge problem, but that actually nowadays CO2 is a big problem. You put carbon dioxide into the air. How does that affect space? Further, that space is described here as prasanna, absolutely clear in the sense of transparent. So your consciousness now is being compared to space, which is one, which is all-pervasive, which is undifferentiated, and which is utterly unaffected by anything in it. In the same way, your consciousness, like space, is all-pervasive. Like space, consciousness is one. Like space, consciousness is undifferentiated. And like space, consciousness is utterly unaffected by whatever is in it and what is in consciousness, as we said before, your mind, your thoughts, your experiences. So, with reference to one who has discovered that truth, with reference to one who is established in that truth, Shankara asks a rhetorical question. He says, Bruta, tell me, kim anyat, what else, karyam ishyate, remains to be accomplished. When you have discovered yourself to be that pure consciousness, described so beautifully, nice language he uses in this verse, for one who has discovered one's true nature as that perfect consciousness, what remains to be accomplished? So Shankara so brilliantly here describes that condition of krita krityata, that state of utter contentment. And this is a good place to conclude today. Om sarve bhavantu sukhinaha, sarve santu niramayaha, sarve bhadrani pashyantu, ma kashchid dukha bhag bhavet, asato ma sadgamaya, tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, mrityor ma amritangamaya. Om shanti shanti shanti. Om. That's it. Good. Nice class.